Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with an interview with Capitol Streets about making streets safer. Then for our peace bucket, we hear about how much of our tax dollars is going to the military. Later on our Mayo on the Brink, we hear about the issue of cameras in the courtroom. After that, Willie Cherry interviews Reverend Ibrahim Pedranon of the Albany County Central Federation of Labor about the labor movement. And we finish up with Amy Godine talking about her latest book, The Black Woods, Pursuing Racial Justice on the Adirondack Frontier, which she will present at the sanctuary on April 30th. But first, headlines.
The Albany County District Attorney's Office is investigating the county's process for awarding American Rescue Plan grants. The district attorney's investigation came after the Times Union raised questions about a proposed $25,000 grant for the Global Organization for Sustainable Development Goals, Inc., a group with no clear ties to the county.
The Times Union reports that the scope of the potential fraud committed by Prime Capital Ventures, an Albany commercial linen firm, may exceed $100 million.
A historic fishing village along the Hudson River in Hudson, New York, dating back to the 1800s, will be documented for posterity before its slated demolition this summer. One shanty might still be preserved.
Visitors seeking to hike some high mountain peaks and other trails from the Adirondack Mountain Reserve on Route 73 in Keene will continue to need a reservation this year. Hikers were able this past week to start making free reservations for parking, which will be required starting May 1st and running through October 31st.
The Schenectady City Council held a public hearing on Monday night on the proposal that would restrict the location of smoke and vape shops in the city to four businesses and manufacturing zone districts. The zoning proposal also restricts from operating within 1,000 feet of any residential lot, 1,000 feet of another smoke shop, and 2,000 feet of a school, park, library, or church. The council may vote on the proposal on May 13th.
Three members of Saratoga Black Lives Matter have filed federal lawsuits against the City of Albany and its police department in connection with the April 2021 protest outside South Station, with the police eventually forcefully removing, after a week, a tent encampment outside the station. Chandler Hickenbottom was injured when a police lieutenant pushed her megaphone into her face, requiring dental work. And that's it for headlines.
Capitol Streets is dedicated to creating a better, safer, and more equitable transportation system in New York's Capital Region. And I interviewed their executive director, James Rath, about some of those some of the projects that they're working on. Transforming our streets to be safer, more functional, and less focused on the passage of cars is a process. Capitol Streets is building a movement to transform the Capitol Region's streets, and I'm here with their executive director, James Rath, to discuss what that process looks like and some of the projects that they're looking at the moment. Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
So you just celebrated your 1 year. You had this celebration, a presentation. Do you have any reflections on this past year?
On the year itself? It really has been super successful. I couldn't have asked for it to go much better. We're feeling really full of gratitude here at Capitol Streets. And it's, you know, a huge effort from the entire community, from myself and Jackie Gonzalez, who's our new project manager and focusing more on issues in Albany. Our board members have been just amazing. And then like everybody in the community who's been involved. You know, looking back at the anniversary party, we had like over 120 people who showed up, and you know, even some representatives who like wanted to come out and talk about these issues and engage with their constituents. And it was, yeah, it was an amazing celebration. And, you know, one of the things I want to really hammer home too is that we're not here to replace the civic engagement that needs to happen around these issues. We're here to like foster and facilitate that and provide some technical analysis that we're going to talk about on how these issues could be actually improved and why these issues are so important. But it really still needs to be something that's coming from the bottom up and is community oriented.
I imagine the processes do differ from project to project, but what does it kind of look like to transform a street or an intersection?
You're right. It does differ a bit based on the context. And we do, you know, alter how we approach things in different contexts. But in general, you know, across the board, what we see in the capital region is most of our intersections and corridors are designed to get people from A to B in a car as quickly as possible. They're not really geared towards, in most locations, making it safer and easier to cross the street, making it a quieter street to live on, you know, a more enjoyable place to sit outside. And so those are some of our goals when we're looking at these projects. And so one of the first places I like to start is just, you know, what is the intent of that corridor? Is it, you know, close to 787? Are people rushing at rush hour to get onto the highway and get off the highway? Is it near a school? Those sorts of pieces of context that might change how we could approach it. We look at the annual average daily traffic counts, which is a mouthful for just saying like how many people are driving on the road. We look at the intersection geometry. We look at, you know, how quickly could a vehicle take that turn, which, you know, also impacts crossing distance, you know, existing conditions analysis on like sidewalks, street trees, all these different things. Yeah, it's almost like trickier for me to talk about it, to be honest, than actually doing it. It feels like right now for me, it's sort of second nature. I know like my family and friends are super sick of hearing me talk about a street design, like while we're walking down the street and we're supposed to just be like getting a cup of coffee or something. I'll be like, oh my God, look at this corner radii or this tactical warning strip or like this raised crosswalk or whatever it might be.
Could you walk us through an example of one of the projects you did recently? You have a Manning Boulevard and a Frisbee Ave Street. Those are two of the projects that you have some memos around. What are some of the memos around these areas?
So those are both in Albany, in the city of Albany. And they were both prompted by the city, you know, announcing that they're going to do a streetscape improvement project on those corridors. So Manning Boulevard between Washington and Western, which are like two of the main corridors in Manning, going kind of uptown and downtown. So Manning Boulevard is sort of a cross town connector, is how I think of it. And it's unique because it has these, what they call bridle paths on either side running parallel to Manning Boulevard, which has like, you know, a unique history about kind of like the upper class folks who would use those to ride carriages, I believe. But right now what it creates is like this super wide right of way. So like the public space between the private spaces where the homes are is like over 120 feet wide, which is absolutely massive. So you can do any sort of thing in that right of way to accommodate people trying to get from A to B. You can do something super creative, like the city, if they wanted to, could do something pie in the sky, like create a park in the middle of it. Now that's not what they're looking to do. And you know, it's not what we're suggesting they do, but it's just an example. Like there's so much space there. And so that corridor is a place where people speed. It is a place where we heard from the residents that on those parallel carriage paths, people are using them as a cut through when there's congestion. So they're getting off of the main drag and they're driving on these bridle paths super fast. And so we took all that context and we looked at what the city was putting forward and we just did a critique of their proposals. They put out two alternatives initially and we said, hey, like we see these proposals, but here's some feedback, things that they weren't thinking about. Yeah, so this is a bit a bit lengthy to kind of explain, but you know, if you're in that area and you're listening to this, and you know, you can go on our website and you can read our Manning Boulevard analysis. There's a really simple graphic on there that actually just calls out those areas. And then looking at like Frisbee Ave, which is a bit simpler, it's this kind of open straight road. Yeah, it's where the sports fields are. So a lot of people from out of the neighborhood are like getting there, whether they're driving or walking or biking, to go to the sports fields. A lot of kids are around, and it's just this big open drag. So what we got into that analysis at a different stage in the process. So the city of Albany didn't put out any alternatives. So we're kind of trying to be more proactive and steering them in a way that we think is going to be the best for the community. And we, you know, we do that by listening to folks at the public meeting. We've listened to the public meeting several times since then. And again, doing that, you know, existing conditions analysis, looking at how much space is actually there, because we don't want to, you know, try to ask the city to do anything crazy, you know, go after eminent domain or anything wild like that. It's just like, there's plenty of space. Let's use it in the best way that possible. And what we put forward in that memo was asking for a side path, which is basically like a trail running parallel to the roadway. So this takes bikes and people riding bikes and people walking off of that busy, dangerous corridor and puts them on a separate facility, which we know are really popular and we know are really comfortable, and it separates them. And what we see with side paths is that it actually does increase not only safety and comfort, but it also increases how many people are going to use that infrastructure and get there on foot and by bike.
So obviously you have the language around this. People who are living there may not have the language. What is the transparency process, and how easy is it for a resident or someone who uses that space to get involved in that process?
Yeah, and that's another thing that sort of differs from project to project. Unfortunately, I think, you know, we do need more transparency in the planning process, and we do need to do more to listen to the voices that are most vulnerable in those communities, the people who, you know, are walking and biking not because it's their favorite thing to do, but maybe it's like the reason that they need, the way they need to get to work or to school. If people want to speak up about these issues, which I think they should, they can pull from the memos that we're providing. You know, they can take a line out of that and send that to their council members, send that to the mayor's office. You know, we're going to the city council in Troy tonight, their finance meeting. They're talking about this massive project on Route 2, which is Congress and Ferry Street downtown, this main corridor, which is right now very busy and sort of divides downtown. And we're going to go there and say, hey, this is a project that I think we will be very supportive of. I think it's going to do amazing things for the city, but we need some more transparency in the process. We've had one stakeholder meeting that Capitol Streets pushed really hard to get. And since then, I think we've received like one small and vague email update. So we really need a public meeting on this project. And I think that, you know, that's something that kind of goes across the board with all these different types of projects.
So our council meeting is tonight, Wednesday, 24th. Thank you so much, James Rath, for joining us from Capitol Streets. You mentioned that your memos are available on your website. Could you let our listeners know how to learn more about Capitol Streets?
CapitolStreets.org under public comments. And we also have a project tracker on our website, on Instagram, and a newsletter that, you know, provides a little bit more info on other things that we're working on too.
So that was James Rath with Capitol Streets and trying to create a safer and more equitable transportation system. And as he pointed out, you can check out their website for more information at www.capitolstreets.org.
Each year at tax time, the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies outlines where your 2023 income taxes went. For our Peace Bucket, Mark talks with Lindsay Koshgarian.
For our Peace Bucket, we're talking with Lindsay Koshgarian, who's a program director of the National Priorities Project. We've had both the project and Lindsay on previously. Of course, April 15th is known as Tax Day, and a lot of the taxes in the federal budget goes to the military, the Pentagon, defense contractors. And so, Lindsay, I notice on your webpage you have a breakdown of how much the average taxpayer is actually contributing to various parts of the federal budget. So do you want to maybe give us some highlights of that?
Sure, Mark. So like you said, every year we do a tax receipt to let people know where their tax dollars are going. Most people have probably, you know, hopefully filed their tax returns by now. But you might know whether you got a refund, but you don't know exactly what your tax dollars were paying for. And so, you know, we give this receipt with the idea that there are some things that people are actually happy to have their taxes support, and other things that people do not want to see their taxes support. And one of the things that we take the closest look at, because it's one of the biggest expenses on your tax receipt, is spending on the military. So this year we found that the average U.S. taxpayer paid over $5,000 for militarism in all its forms and its support systems. And that includes spending on the Pentagon and war. It includes spending on deportations and detentions and militarization of our borders. It includes spending on mass incarceration and federal law enforcement, policing, and it includes spending on veterans, because that, you know, all of our veterans programs, while they're very necessary, are really support systems for our war and military. So when we put all those things together, the average taxpayer is paying over $5,000 for all of that. And the biggest chunk of that by far is for the Pentagon and military. The average taxpayer gave over $2,900 in 2023 to the Pentagon itself. And the biggest part of that is for Pentagon contractors. So we take a really close look at that as well to see what people are giving to the corporate contractors that absorb about half of the Pentagon budget every year.
Now, you often hear that I think somewhere over 50, maybe even 60% of the discretionary budget goes to the military. But if you include Medicare and Medicaid, which is perhaps one of the bigger parts of the federal budget, the military budget still exceeds Medicare and Medicaid?
Yes. So our tax receipt also looks at Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare in particular is largely funded by a trust fund. And that means it's not funded by your income tax dollars as much. But it is some, and Medicaid is. And so one of the things we look at there is what you're paying for those things. And what we found there is that the average taxpayer is giving about $4,300 to Medicare and Medicaid. And these programs have been tremendously successful. Nearly all Americans age 65 and older are and have been insured thanks to Medicare. That is not true of me, that there is not a program like that for any other age group that covers as many people as that. And then thanks to expanded Medicaid and Obamacare or American Care or ACA subsidies, the number of uninsured Americans hit a record low in 2022. So, you know, the U.S. is famous for not providing universal health care for its citizens, and that is still true. But through all of these programs and the increased spending under all of these programs, we have come the closest to universal health coverage that we've ever been.
I'll just quickly note, I for many years was one of the lead organizers in New York State for single-payer healthcare, which some people should be called expanded and improved Medicare for all. But as somebody who recently has now been qualified for Medicare, I recognize how, in fact, incomplete Medicare actually is. And the average senior citizen still ends up spending well over $100,000 to supplement to Medicare. But one of the things I was also sort of struck about, a couple other issues I worked on for many years, was hunger. And so while we're spending over $5,000 average for the military, we're only spending $516 for food stamps. And then my new pet issue is climate change, and we're only spending $10.84 to bat climate change. Does even the average congressman understand how warped their spending priorities are?
That's a good question. I think there's a lot of folks in Congress who take for granted these spending priorities, and particularly the huge spending on the Pentagon and the Pentagon contractors. But I don't think a lot of them appreciate, honestly, just how low our spending on renewable energy and energy efficiency for the climate crisis, just how low that spending is. So I think it's a point to make kind of over and over again to let people know, like you said, you know, we're $5,000 for militarism. People are spending, the average taxpayer is spending $1,700 just for Pentagon contractors, just for the corporations. And then, like you said, $10.84 for renewable energy and energy efficiency. Now, that's not all of the programs, because many of the programs in the Inflation Reduction Act, for example, were tax credits. And so that's not direct spending, and it doesn't show up in that number. But it's still an absurdly low figure. And, you know, you mentioned climate change being a pet issue, but, you know, it's got to be a lot more than a pet issue for and I think you were, you know, being euphemistic a bit, but it's got to be a lot more than a pet issue for all of us, because it is shaping our futures. It is shaping our lives. Their severe weather events have been getting more frequent and getting more extreme. More of us are experiencing things like flooding or wildfires or smoke from wildfires, which, even though I don't live anywhere near wildfires, was a big issue in my area last year and is increasingly frequent. So it's, I think members of Congress aren't looking at this closely enough, but it's less an issue of awareness for them and more an issue of giving them a reason to do something different. And mm-hmm. So that's where people can come in and give their member of Congress a reason to do something different.
So we only have a little bit over two minutes. So that's a two-part question, one part being we can get people about more information. But staying on climate, many of us are very disturbed at the recent COP. The United States only pledged, I think, $12.5 million to deal with loss and damages, to pay for the damages being caused in the Global South. And then, yes, in the last week, they put together this military aid package, $61 billion for Ukraine, $26 billion for Israel, and then $8 billion for Asian countries to basically counter China. Now, not all that was direct military spending, but still, these are enormous numbers.
They are enormous numbers. And I just want to underscore what you said about million versus billion, right? These numbers aren't even on the same scale. So it's a huge, tremendous difference. And it's frightening that members of Congress are willing to throw tens of billions of dollars into these wars and can't come up with sums like that, especially when it comes to international climate issues. Like you said, the figures then are typically in the millions or maybe 1 billion. And which one of those is a bigger security threat actually to people in the United States? You know, a lot of the wars are not necessarily Ukraine or Gaza, but a lot of conflicts around the world are actually driven by climate change. And the fact that we're just not, our politicians are not willing to spend to counter climate change is going to be a growing problem. And the willingness that they've shown, even as hard as it was for, there was lots of drama. It took a while for them to pass this package, but they did it. And that actually goes to show that if they had that same determination to pass a major, for example, international climate change package, they could do that as well.
So if people want more information, or they want to, you know, maybe nudge their Congress people to actually understand what they're doing with the budget, get a website?
Yes, our website is www.nationalpriorities.org.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Lindsay Kashkarian, Program Director, National Priorities Project. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. So for many years on tax day, I used to sit out in front of the Albany Public Library with jars labeled education, healthcare, the environment, job creation, job training, and the military. And we give people 10 pennies and say, invest your pennies how you would like to see our federal budget went. And for some reason, the military always came in pretty low on the priorities, but it's just the power of the campaign contributions in the military-industrial complex. But for those just tuning in, I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, and streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
If you like what you hear, you can support this program by sharing our content. You can find today's stories and more at mediasanctuary.org.
In this week's Armeo on the Brink, Rosemary talks with Phyllis Jordan and Mark Mahoney and how to balance the rights of a free press with the rights of defendants on the issues of cameras in the courtroom.
Listen to this segment of On the Brink with Rosemary Armeo, or listen to it in full on your favorite podcast platform. We're talking this week about balancing the right of a free press with the rights of defendants to a fair trial and the safeties of juries. Guess what trial we're really talking about? Should there be cameras in the courtroom? His supporters don't believe he was really napping. They think it was just Maggie Haberman, who hates him, who's spreading bad stories about him. Should cameras be in that courtroom? And should jurors be getting the kind of protection they're getting? In this past week, the judge asked reporters to please not even physically describe the jurors because they were feeling intimidated. What's going on there? What do you think? Can Trump get a fair trial in Manhattan? Can the press, are they doing a good job covering?
Yeah, first, I think he can get a fair trial. I mean, there's 8 million people living in Manhattan and New York City, and, you know, they only need to get 18 or 16 jurors, whatever. So they've already got 12. So obviously they're finding a way to get jurors out of that giant jury pool. So starting with the cameras in the courtroom, of course there should be cameras in the courtroom of any kind of trial that's up. This one really necessitates the public being able to watch for themselves, because they're not going to trust the reporters to accurately depict, you know, did he fall asleep? Was he just looking down at his notes? Was he disinterested? Was he interested? Was he smirking? Was he smiling? Was he intimidating? All that is subject to interpretation of the reporters in the room. And, you know, they're doing their best job, and I'm sure they're reporting it accurately. But, you know, people aren't going to always believe what they hear from the press, especially, you know, when they think that this trial is, you know, inappropriate, or, you know, as a witch hunt or anything like that. And they think that the media is out to get them and all that other stuff. This would have been an opportune time to have cameras in the courtroom and focused on his conduct and the judge's conduct. Is the judge picking on him? Is he being belligerent? Is he being fair, unfair, whatever? You would have that on, you know, for all of us to see and judge for ourselves. So, I did write an editorial last week reminding people, maybe it was earlier this week, reminding people that we don't have cameras in the courtroom. I think the timing, too, is interesting because, O.J. Simpson died. And we saw what a fiasco that mm-hmm. was when his trial was televised. And I think there was more, he was playing to the camera. OJ was, his lawyers were, the judge was, the prosecutors, everybody kind of, you know, but that was what, 30 years ago. Now, you know, cameras are more common. People are used to having them around. I don't think they're as cognizant of them. Trump obviously would be playing to the cameras, but we don't know what he'd be doing playing to the cameras. He might be trying to say more things or whatever. But I think I think this wouldn't have been the fiasco that the OJ trial was. And I think it actually would have given the public, you know, more comfort that what was being reported was accurate and more trust in it. Again, not to say the reporters aren't doing an accurate job or whatever, but people really want to see with their own eyes and hear with their own ears what's going on there. I think it would have been good if they had them.
Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC made what I thought was a really interesting argument recently. He said, What are they doing? Setting up essentially a conference room with this bank of microphones right outside of the courthouse. The judge is not going using it. He's not going in front of the microphones. The prosecutors are not. But twice a day, Donald Trump is coming out of that courthouse and giving a speech, giving his version, which we know to be very deceitful and untrue. And he's been handed a national audience. Was that smart? Phyllis, you had a... Mark, and then come back to you. Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. I go back and forth on that. My first thought was what you just made. Like, why are they just giving him this opportunity? But the reality is the press is giving him that opportunity. The press wants to hear what he has to say. But the second thing I think is what I've seen, and I haven't seen it all, but what I've seen, he's coming across as whiny. He is not coming across as a strong guy. He's coming across as, I'm annoyed that the judge won't let me do everything I want to do. I'm annoyed I can't use my phone in the courtroom. I'm annoyed I can't do this and that. Mm-hmm. And what's he going to say when you have people like Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen up there? He's just going to come out and be like he is on Truth Social, where he's just bashing people. And you know, I don't know that that's a good look for him. I agree with you. It doesn't seem right to give him this national audience, but I don't think he's going to use it well.
Okay. Mark, what do you say? We interrupted you.
I think his whining is part of his, you know, appeal. You know, I think any complaint he makes, I mean, we might view it as whining and, you know, being whatever, but you know, every time he complains about something, his followers, you know, take it as a legitimate criticism of the court. You know, when he was arguing about how he should have an unlimited number of challenges to jurors without cause. And, you know, that's ridiculous. The court rules are what they are. And, you know, everybody has to follow them, all criminal defendants have to follow. But when he goes on there and whines that he should be able to dismiss anybody he wants, the people that follow him aren't, you know, always the most informed about court procedures and about, you know, what's going on. So they're going to believe it. So all his whining, you know, that we view as whining is actually him playing to his base. And I think that works. He seems to have, you know, been behaving himself, you know, to the most part. He hasn't given big speeches or anything like that. And the judge seems to be keeping control of the courtroom from what we've seen so far. You know, what he says outside the courtroom, he's allowed to do that. And, you know, he's got a built-in audience. He's who he is, and he's going to do that. So, you know,
so let's go back to my other question about the jurors who are getting unprecedented protection. The judge very clearly wants an anonymous jury. And to me, this seems dangerous. The reason that reporters want to talk to jurors is to find out what goes on in those deliberations, which are secret, and which press coverage has revealed problems in the past, inappropriate considerations, even harassment and bullying. And in a trial of Donald Trump, with all of the politics involved, all the witness protection, that sort of check on what goes on there seems even more important to me than usual. So should these jurors, do they need the protection? And what happens if they were to be treated? And the press has been, may I say, very aggressive. They're even now talking to people who have been asked to be jurors and have been dismissed. They're getting interviewed. It's crazy. What do you think?
I think it's amazing that in effect we're using the same jury rules that we use for mafia dons with this don, and that, you know, these jurors are in danger from these MAGA people who want to intimidate them. So I think the media needs to step aside and let these jurors have their privacy and not try to get their details and not try to report their details and leave the jurors out of it, because I think this is going to be tough enough. It's one thing to be a prosecutor and have people intimidating you and threatening your family, but to be just an ordinary citizen and have that happening. So I think the press needs to step back and give jurors their space and stay out of this, because I think it is a dangerous mission they're taking on, and they're doing it for the whole country. So we should thank them and protect them.
I agree with that.
It's not a journalistic viewpoint, but that's my viewpoint.
Exactly. Mine too. And it's the same thing. It's like, as a journalist, I should, you know, want everybody to talk and everybody should be public and everything like that. But these people, you saw one juror got dismissed today because, you know, Fox and I think maybe the Washington Post released a lot of information about them that people could identify her.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's anticipating, you know, what can happen with the people who follow Trump. They do threaten people's lives and that sort of thing, you know, and it's, this, their job there is to listen to the facts and decide guilt or innocence. And, you know, that's their function. And so I think that they, their identities do need to be protected in this case. I think their privacy needs to be protected. I think the press does need to back off and kind of put them out of it. You know, when you're talking with cameras in the courtroom, the rules generally for, you know, even when they do allow them or when they used to allow them, was that they could, and the bill that's in the legislature to allow cameras in the courtroom would allow judges to exclude certain people from being viewed or being, you know, interviewed, maybe not their identities, you know, after, but you wouldn't be able to see their pictures, whatever. And I think it's important to protect the integrity of the court process by protecting, especially in this case, the identity of the jurors, because you know what can happen to them in something like this.
Okay, I hear what you're both saying, and I get it. But I keep being reminded that there are two articles in the Bill of Rights at issue here. And fair trial is one, the other is the free press. And for good reasons, we keep giving up civil rights. And I just see us giving way again on this. If reporters cannot talk to jurors and make up rules to protect them, I'm fine with that. But to what we have now is they're just being totally excluded. And we are not going to find out what goes on in jury deliberations. We are not going to find out what jurors are thinking. And that is a loss. And I regret that. I want us to come up with some solution that's in between, that isn't just the press, as you put it, Phyllis, backing off.
And that was Armeo on the Brink, and Rosemary was talking to Phyllis Jordan and Mark Mahoney. I'll mention that my longtime neighbor, the late Jonathan Gradess, for decades was head of the New York State Defenders Association, representing public defenders in New York State. And he was one of the most vocal opponents of cameras in the courtroom, someone who really believed the right to a fair trial was far more important than, especially this corporate-owned media, who's not very interested at all in the truth, but is more interested in ratings. But I recognize it's a challenging issue with different opinions.
Next is the third segment of roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry's interview with Reverend Ibrahim Petrinan, the president of the Albany County Central Federation of Labor, about the state of the labor movement.
And there's another hot issue that I want to ask you about.
Too. Sure.
And that's the AI issue.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of schools of thoughts about AI. Some saying that AI won't really take jobs away from workers, that it just move them to different categories. And there's another school of thought saying that AI definitely will take jobs away from workers.
Sure.
So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it depends. It depends on, well, there are a couple things I think about that. It depends on how much power workers build to have contracts that say you're not going to, like, lose jobs to AI, right? Like, that has to be a written agreement. It can't be a handshake or, you know, the word of the boss is only so far as that pen goes, you know? And if it's not written, it's not real. In terms of, you know, so, I mean, this gets into a sort of a meta question about technology just in general, right? Mm-hmm. Automation, technology, AI, all of these things in a society that prioritized people, all of these things would work to the benefit of everyone. However, AI and these, you know, these technologies are not being used for the benefit of the people. They're being used for the benefit of the billionaires and the ruling class and this group of people who, again, wants to pay workers nothing if they don't have to. And so I think that at a certain level, you know, we've heard these complaints before, you know, whether that's, automation is gonna destroy us. You know, computers are going to take all of our jobs. AI, you know, there's always going to be that threat because there are always going to be people who don't want to pay workers and don't want to pay workers fairly. I think it's always going to be an issue.
And there's a lot of unions down there that I read that when they renegotiate their contract, now they're putting that AI clause.
Exactly right. So, you know, I don't know if the postal workers are going to put that in our contract because we're coming up on a contract cycle. Mm-hmm. But it is a really interesting question. And I know that at our meeting last night, the musicians, you know, they were saying, AI is also terrifying for musicians because all you need to do is, you know, program a little bit of this, get a little smattering of this person's voice. Mm-hmm. And now you can actually just clone, really, like this person's voice and make it do whatever you want it to do. You know, they call these deep fakes in imagery and in terms of, you know, I heard a Beyonce song being sung by Johnny Cash and I was like, wait, what is this? You know, and I was like, I don't think this is possible. But it was just AI had figured out how to do that. So it is very scary for a lot of folks in terms of, you know, their rights, their abilities, the screen actors, you know, when you can kind of make AI do, you can put someone's face on, you know, on anything. Yeah, it gets really scary, you know, because now you don't need human beings. But I also think that, like, this has been a perennial issue, and we as workers just need to make sure that the technology is working for us and working for workers and not for the bosses.
Okay.
And for society. So, you know, I think that workers and unionists take a view beyond just themselves,
right.
and need to do that. You know, we saw the Chicago teachers, you know, they advocated for, like, community parks as part of their bargaining because they recognize what that does to people outside of the four walls of what they're up to. And so I think that that's valuable.
Right. You know, I have a whole lot of other questions to ask you,
sure.
But I'm not going to burn you.
Oh, no,
we're going to talk again.
Sounds good.
Right. But I do want to ask you about the membership.
Sure.
You know, because I know that a lot of issues and struggles, union members find it hard to try to get their membership to get involved in this.
100%. 150%.
Right? And I don't know what strategy they have to use or do, but what are your ideas in terms of what issues that will activate union members
right.
to get involved?
I mean, that's the perennial question, Willie. I mean, that's the question. I mean, we asked, literally, Willie, we asked this question last night at the Labor Council meeting, and everyone had the same kind of deer in the headlights, you know. And I think it comes back to having relationships and having one-on-one conversations, knowing what you want, and having the relationships and the conversations with people to get you there. I think those two things are really the quintessence of it. They take a lot of time. And right now, you know, we're being bombarded with all this extra stuff and all this extra, you know, X, Y, and Z stuff. So we feel like we don't have the time. I know for me personally, like, you know, I'll put something in a newsletter and then just expect people to read it. But then I'll get a newsletter and I won't read it, you know. And so it's kind of like, you know, but if someone calls or texts or whatever, you know, that's wholly different. I treat that very differently because it's more intentional and it's more personal. And I think that that's ultimately where we have to be.
Okay. All right. Is there any other thing you want to say or any point you want to make?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so one of the things that we're really excited about, I think, is that there are a couple events that we just want to, like, be excited about. Yeah. So on April 27th, mm-hmm. Area Labor Federation is having the annual business meeting. So that's going to be from 10 a.m. Till about 12 p.m. And that's going to be, you know, a union business meeting. Union members and union folks are welcome to be there. It, you know, in terms of voting, that's for delegates, but ultimately it's going to be great. And then at 1:30 on the same day on Saturday, April 27th, is International Workers Memorial Day. And that's always a very solemn time to remember folks who have died, either occupational, you know, due to occupational hazards, or either died on the job. Unfortunately, we do have some suicides this year, and a homicide, I believe, that are all folks in the Capital Region who've died in the course of their work. And that's really... something I think that we have to remember.
And that's open for everybody.
And that's open for everybody, yep. I think it was Mother Jones who says, mourn the dead, but fight like hell for the living. And so that's kind of the mantra of that day. So that's going to be on April 27th, and I think that's going to be, again, here in the Labor Temple.
What's the address of the Labor Temple?
890 3rd Street, Albany, New York, 12206. And so we'll be having that again on April 27th from 10 a.m. to 12. And then there will be a lunch, so you know you can come and enjoy lunch, and then at 1:30 is the second portion, the International Workers Memorial Day. Then right after that, I mean, there's so much going on. Right after that, we've got the is May Day. So May Day is International Workers Day. We're going to be meeting at the New Scotland Starbucks over right by Albany Medical Center at 10 a.m. to have coffee and celebrate those workers. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to have our meeting, our Labor Council meeting, that first Wednesday, which is May Day, here at the Labor Temple as well. And I think we're going to have some food, maybe some music, and just trying to get to enjoy folks a little bit more. But we're going to start that probably 6 o'clock, maybe even a little bit earlier than that. And then shortly after that, a week and a half after that, we're going to be at Tulip Fest here in Albany, and we're going to be tabling to talk with people about unions, about unionization, about having those conversations to make sure that, you know, we're engaged. And then on Tuesday, May 14th at NYSET, is the American Labor Study Center annual gathering that they have. And on Wednesday, May 22nd, here at the Labor Temple, is the Labor Religion Coalition's annual gathering. So the next, over the next month, or, you know, 6 weeks, is going to be a lot of labor-oriented things, which is always exciting. It's always a lot to get involved with. But yeah, so excited about labor religion, excited about the American Labor Studies Center, excited about Tulip being at Tulip Fest, excited about the Area Labor Federation business meeting, and the International Workers Memorial Day. So just like lots to put on the calendar. That's how we build worker power. Yeah, Ibrahim Pedrinyan, president of the Albany County Central Federation of Labor.
And the American Postal Worker Union Local 390.
That's it. And what do we always say? All power to the workers.
Hey, the struggle continues.
That's right.
Thank you.
So I will say that Ibrahim is an actually wonderful labor leader, and both the Albany County Central Federation of Labor and the Troy Area Labor Federation are both great organizations. They are largely marginalized within the larger labor movement in New York State. And as somebody who's been 50 years as an organizer, most of that time on economic justice, I continue to pray for the day that the labor movement in the United States develops a sense of working class solidarity. And it's just so disappointing to see the mixed record on labor on so many issues, from opposing single-payer health care in New York to having a very mixed record on climate. But fortunately, we have a Roman labor correspondent, Willie Cherry, to keep us up to speed on the best of the labor movement here in the Capital District.
On Tuesday, April 30th, Amy Godine will give a book talk at the Sanctuary for Independent Media about her latest book, The Black Woods. She spoke with me about the book, the research, and what will make this book talk in Troy unique. The Black Woods, Pursuing Racial Justice on the Adirondack Frontier, is a book that chronicles the dramatic history of the Black pioneers in New York's northern wilderness. The author, Amy Godine, is coming to the Sanctuary for Independent Media on April 30th for a 7 p.m. book talk on the Black Woods, and she joins me now. Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Wonderful.
So Amy Gadeen, can you tell us a little bit about yourself as an author?
Well, I've been writing as long as I can remember, but I got interested in ethnic history, in particular in the Adirondacks, because when I moved to the region, to Saratoga Springs, I saw that nobody seemed to be writing about this. It's something I'd written about in Oregon when I lived there, and I thought, there's got to be a story here. There always is. Dig a little and you'll find something. And I wrote about so many different ethnic groups and ethnic migratory experiences in the region. And I also was struck by how little this story was represented in conventional Adirondack history, that I kept going until I was approached by Martha Swan of John Brown Lives, an activist who wanted to bring to life the story of John Brown in the Adirondacks when he lived at North Elba and came to help a group of Black settlers in the region. And I didn't think there was any story there at all. I'd read about it, and it seemed as if the folks who came didn't stay very long and didn't do very well and were pretty much missing in action after a few years. But I said I'd do a little homework and we'd see if we had an exhibit on this or not. And I turned up so much more than I expected that I realized I had not just an exhibition, but the beginnings of a book project. And that's what led me to publish this book and discover so much about this lost history.
Oh, it began as an exhibition. What was the exhibition like, and how did that evolve into the book?
Well, the exhibition started, it's called Dreaming of Timbuktu, and it's had a long shelf life. It opened in 2000 at the Adirondack, then it was called the Adirondack Museum. Now it's the Adirondack Experience, and it traveled all over the state and eventually found a permanent home at the John Brown Farm State Historic Site in North Elba, because the story is so original for so many people who come to the region and don't expect to discover any particle of Black history that connects to the Adirondack region, which is sort of famously a non-ethnic world, an all-white world in most people's minds who come there, except for the experience of all the many prisons in the region. And that's how people associated with the Black experience. And here was this other completely fresh story of a Black farm group that moves north in stages over many years to farm, but also to gain voting rights. So it's a civil rights story in the heart of the Adirondacks. And this too came as a stunner for many people. So the exhibition has just had a long standing currency that just hasn't faded, because all the issues that provoked this initiative are still with us. They haven't died away at all. So that gave rise to the book. I just thought, I can go with this, go deeper, go wider, take it as far as I can get, and we'll see what happens. And what came out of it was the book you have in your hand.
So it evolved, you got more information, it turned into the Black Woods pursuing racial justice on the Adirondack frontier. What would you like us to know about the book, and how does it expand on that exhibition?
Well, the exhibition really focuses on the community within the neighborhood of John Brown's farm, which is still there, of course. It's the heart of the historic site. And while we don't know exactly where the Black settlers lived, because none of their farms are still around, they were poor farms, they weren't made to last, and they didn't last over such a long span of time. Old farms have a way of falling apart. So the material culture in this story is very thin on the ground, but the literary culture, the written culture of how these farmers, their families, their children, left paper records in legal documents, in school records, voting records, tax records, and pension appeal records after the Civil War is quite rich. And that's where I found the heart of my story. And that just kept me going. You asked about the book in particular, though. It's really a three-part book. The first part is about why this was an important initiative in the first place, because you could only vote if you were Black at mid-century in New York State if you owned $250 worth of landed property, which rule effectively disenfranchised all of Black New York. And so the effort to disperse land to 3,000 Black New Yorkers was an attempt to enfranchise Black New Yorkers and give them political power, the right to vote and the right to self-representation. So that's the first part of the book. It sets the story and the reason for it, the rationale, why it held so much appeal for so many Black activists and radical anti-slavery reformers. And the second part deals with the experience of the grantees on the land as settlers, those few hundred who actually move, who set up there, who build their farms. Most of them don't stay. Most of them move on. Many move back to the cities they came from, and a good number move to other farms and continue farming elsewhere. That part of the book deals with the lived experience of the Black grantees. And the third part deals with this story in memory, how it was represented on the page, or more accurately, how it was scrubbed and diminished and denigrated and denied, and how far we've come in our effort to retrieve it and recover it in the last decade or two. Three parts. That's why it's so long.
Amy Godine, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you, and we're very excited for your book talk on the Black Woods on Tuesday, April 30th. Before I let you go, what can visitors expect from that event, from your book talk?
Oh, I usually try to pitch what I'm talking about to the audience I'm speaking to. And in this case, I'll be talking to a lot of folks from Troy in the Capital District. It turns out that Troy was probably the greatest provider of settlers, not just grantees, but grantee settlers who actually moved into the Adirondacks. And I'll talk about why was Troy such a pivotal force? What were the influences that inspired the grantees from Troy, not New York City, not Utica, not Ithaca, not Brooklyn, but Troy, New York, to go into the Adirondack Woods and try and make a life there? And that'll be a special emphasis in the talk I give at the sanctuary, to which I'm really looking forward.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
So, Alice Green is a person who, African-American, who grew up in the Adirondacks, is almost the only African-American family in the 50s and 60s in the Adirondacks. And I see she has a review of the book in the Adirondack Explorers, where she says, boy, I wish I had this book when I was growing up. So I actually knew more about the history of African-Americans in the Adirondacks. So that's going to be Tuesday, April 3rd at 7 p.m., the Black Woods. You can register at mediasanctuary.org. And we'll have an intro by Jeff Jones of John Brown Lives.
And that's our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Sina Bazilahiki.
And I'm Mark Dillon. We want to thank our wonderful engineer, Joan Eason. And we want to thank all our volunteers who made today's episode possible. This is a team effort. Willie Terry, Rosemary Armeo, and Zachary Grady. This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation by going to mediasanctuary.org.
We want to hear from you. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Hudson Mohawk Mag, or send us an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Tune in weekdays at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Full episodes and individual stories are available on demand at our website and on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks to you, our listeners, for making this all worthwhile.